While the chemistry between Warren and his teacher was obvious to everyone else in the class, one student in particular had taken note of him. Bill Ruane, a stockbroker at Kidder Peabody, had found his way to Graham through his alma mater, Harvard Business School, after reading two important and memorable books, Where Are the Customer's Yachts? And Security Analysis. Ruane loved telling tales about his stockbroking job, though he swore that his first choice of career was working as an elevator boy at the Plaza Hotel, a future derailed by a lengthy wait for a uniform. He and Warren had connected immediately, but neither Ruane nor any other of Graham's students, nor Warren himself, ever had the temerity to try to see Graham outside the seminar room. Warren did manage to find reasons, however, to drop in on his new acquaintance Walter Schloss down at the Graham Newman Corporation. He got to know Schloss better and learned he was caring for a wife who had been suffering from depression throughout most of their marriage. Schloss, like David Dodd, appeared to be remarkably loyal and steadfast, qualities that Buffett sought out in people. He also envied Schloss his job. He would have cleaned the washrooms for free in exchange for one of those gray laboratory-style jackets made of thin cotton that everyone at Graham Newman wore to keep from dirtying their shirt sleeves while they filled out the forms that Graham used to test stocks against his investing criteria. Above all, Warren wanted to work for Graham. As the semester neared an end, the rest of the class was busy finding their futures. Bob Dunn would be heading off to U.S. Steel, possibly the most prestigious corporate job in the United States. Almost every young businessman saw the route to success as working his way up the ladder in a great industrial corporation. In Eisenhower's post-war, post-depression America, job security was all important, and Americans believed that institutions, from the government to large corporations, were essentially benevolent. Finding one's cell inside the institutional beehive and learning how to fit in was the normal and expected thing to do. I don't think there was one guy in the class that thought about whether U.S. Steel was a good business. I mean, it was a big business, but they weren't thinking about what kind of train they were getting on. Warren had one goal in mind. He knew he would excel if Graham would hire him. While lacking self-confidence in many things, he had always felt sure-footed in the specialized area of stocks. He proposed himself to Graham for a job at Graham Newman Corporation. It took audacity to even dream of working for the great man himself, but Warren was audacious. He was, after all, Ben Graham's star student, the only one to earn an A-plus in his class. If Walter Schloss could work there, why couldn't he? To clinch the deal, he offered to work for free. He went in and asked for the job with far more confidence than he had felt riding up to Chicago for his interview with the Harvard Business School. Graham turned him down. He was terrific. He just said, "Look at Warren. In Wall Street, still, the white shoe firms, the big investment banks, they don't hire Jews. We only have the ability to hire a very few people here, and therefore, we only hire Jews." That was true of the two gals in the office and everybody. It was sort of like his version of affirmative action. And the truth is, there was a lot of prejudice against Jews in the 50s. I understood. Buffett found it impossible to say anything that could be interpreted as critical of Graham, even decades later. Of course, it must have been incredibly disappointing. Couldn't Graham have made an exception for his star student? Someone it wouldn't cost him anything to employ? Warren, who idolized his teacher, had to accept that Graham viewed him impersonally, so much so that he would not overrule a principal even for the best student who had ever taken his class. There was no appeal, at least for now. Chagrined, he stayed through graduation, then once again he pulled himself together and stepped aboard a train. He had two consolations. He would be back in Omaha, where he felt he belonged, and it would be much easier to pursue his love life there, for he had met an Omaha girl and was now smitten. As usual, the girl he wanted was not smitten with him, but this time he was determined to change her mind. Chapter 18. Miss Nebraska. New York City and Omaha, 1950 to 1952. Warren had always been a washout with girls. He longed to have a girlfriend, but the very things that made him different hindered his quest. "Nobody was more shy than I was with girls," he says. but my reaction to that was probably to turn into a talking machine. When he ran out of words about stocks or politics, he resorted to grunts. He was afraid to ask girls out. He summoned the nerve when a girl occasionally did something that made him think he wouldn't get turned down, but in general his attitude was, "Why would they want to go out with me?" Thus, he didn't go on many dates during high school or college, and when he did, something always seemed to go wrong. On a date to a baseball game with a girl named Jackie Gillian, the high point was hitting a cow with his car on the way home. He took another girl to hit golf balls at a driving range. That didn't fly. Driving a hearse to pick up Barbara Wiegand, he says, was sort of desperate, not a stunt. It may have worked as an icebreaker, but after that, what was there to say? On a date with a shy girl like Anne Beck, he was struck mute. He was so insecure that he had no idea what to do. Girls didn't want to hear about Ben Graham and the margin of safety. If he couldn't get to first base with Bobby Worley, who had dated him all one summer, what hope did he have? Very little, he thought, and maybe the girls could sense it. Finally, the summer of 1950, before he went to Columbia, his sister Bertie set him up on a date with her roommate from Northwestern, a round-cheeked cupie of a brunette named Susan Thompson. She had quickly impressed Bertie, who was a year and a half younger, as a special girl with a knack for understanding people. As soon as Warren met Susie, he was fascinated, but suspected she was too good to be true. I bet she was a fake at first. I was intrigued by her, and I was pursuing her, but I was determined to find the hole in the dike. I just couldn't believe anybody was really like her. Susie, however, was not interested in him. She was in love with somebody else. After Warren went off to Columbia, he read in Earl Wilson's gossip column in the New York Post that Miss Nebraska, 1949, Vanita Mae Brown, was living at the Webster Women's Residence and performing with the singer and teen idol Eddie Fisher on a television show. Vanita had attended the University of Nebraska at the same time as Warren, although she had escaped his notice and aspirations until now. Something about the situation overcame his shyness. Since the glamorous Miss Nebraska was living in New York, he telephoned her at the Webster. Vanita took the bait. Before long, she and Mr. Omaha had a date. He learned that her upbringing had been nothing like his. She grew up in South Omaha near the stockyards, cleaning chickens at Omaha Cold Storage after school. Her pin-up body and girl-next-door face had been her ticket out. She got a job in Omaha as an usherette at the Paramount Theater, then parlayed her love of putting herself on display into victory in a local beauty pageant. "I think her talent was bedazzling the judges," Buffett says. After winning the Miss Nebraska title, she represented the state as Princess Nebraska in the Washington, D.C. Cherry Blossom Festival. From there, she moved to New York City, where she was now desperately trying to make it in show business. Although Warren was not the kind of guy to take a girl to dinner at the Stork Club or a show at the Copacabana, she must have welcomed a hometown face. Soon, the two of them were exploring the streets of New York together. Looking to upgrade themselves, they went to Marble Collegiate Church to hear Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, a famous self-improvement writer and speaker. Warren serenaded her with Sweet Georgia Brown by Ukulele on the Bank of the Hudson, toting along cheese sandwiches as Riverside picnic fare. Even though Vanita hated cheese sandwiches, she seemed willing to keep seeing him. He found her so entertaining and quick-witted that talking to her was like playing verbal ping-pong. The aura of technicolor that surrounded her made her magnetizing. Vanita's interest did not delude him, however, about his woefully lacking social skills. With each passing year, he had become more desperate to improve them. He'd seen an ad for a public speaking course in the Dale Carnegie method. Warren trusted Dale Carnegie, who had already helped him to get along better with people. He went to a Carnegie course in New York with a $100 check in his pocket. "I went to Dale Carnegie because I was painfully aware of being socially maladjusted, and I went and gave them a check, but then I stopped payment on it because I lost my nerve." Nor did Warren's social deficiencies augur well for his prospects with Susan Thompson, to whom he had been writing all fall. She was not encouraging, but neither did she tell him outright to stop bothering her. Warren quickly hit on the strategy of befriending Susie's parents as a gateway to their daughter. Over Thanksgiving, he went to Evanston with them for a Northwestern football game. Afterward, the three of them had dinner with Susie, but she ditched them early to go out on a date. Warren returned to New York after the holiday, discouraged but no less intrigued. He continued to see Vanita. "She had one of the most imaginative minds I've ever run into," he says. In fact, dating her began to take on an edge of unpredictability and risk. At various times, she threatened to go down to Washington when Howard was speaking on the floor of Congress and throw herself at his feet, shrieking, "Your son is the father of my unborn child." Warren thought she might actually do it. Another time, she created such a scene as they left a movie theater that, unable to listen to it any longer, he hoisted her up and stuffed her, jackknifed, into a wire mesh trash basket on the street corner. She hung there, suspended and screaming as he stalked away. Vanita was beautiful. She was smart, and she was entertaining. She was also dangerous, and Warren knew it was risky to get more involved with her. But there must have been some sort of thrill to it. Dating Vanita was like walking a leopard on a leash to see if it would make a good pet. Yet, Vanita could handle herself fine. She had no problem carrying it off. The only question was whether she was going to want to carry it off. You didn't have to worry about her embarrassing you unless she wanted to. Once, Warren invited her to a dinner at the New York Athletic Club for Frank Matthews, a distinguished lawyer and secretary of the Navy. Having the beautiful Miss Nebraska on his arm would be a plus. Matthews was Nebraskan. The crowd was full of people worth knowing, and Warren wanted to be known. During the cocktail hour, Vanita made sure he would indeed be talked about. After he introduced her as his date, she corrected him and insisted she was his wife. "I don't know why he does this," she said. "Is he ashamed of me? Would you be ashamed of me? Every time we go out, he pretends that I'm just his date, and we've been married." Finally, Warren realized that even though Vanita could handle herself just fine when she wanted to, the truth was that she would always want to embarrass me. "She preferred acting that way with me," he says, "and she did so regularly." Vanita had a fascination about her, however, and had he not had an alternative, there is no telling what would have happened next. Every time Warren went home to Nebraska, he saw Susan Thompson as much as she allowed, even though it wasn't much. To him, she seemed immensely sophisticated, even authoritative, and generous with her emotions. "Susie was way, way, way more mature than I was," he says. He started falling hard for her and disentangling himself from Vanita, even though it was obvious I wasn't number one with Susie. "My intentions were clear," he says. "They just weren't having any effect on her." Susan Thompson's family was well known to the Buffetts. In fact, it was her father, Doc Thompson, who had managed Howard's only failed re-election campaign. But in most respects, they were as different as could be from Warren's. Susie's mother, Dorothy Thompson, a sweet, tiny woman, warm, genuine, and wise to the world, was known in the family as the wife who went along. She made sure dinner was on the table at 6 p.m. sharp and supported the many lives her husband, Dr. William Thompson, led. A smallish, silver-haired peacock of a man who wore bow ties and dressed in three-piece wool suits in lavender or cotton candy pink or chartreuse, he cut a striking figure and carried himself with the posture of someone who was confident that he was being admired. He came, he said, from a long line of teachers and preachers, and seemed to want to replicate all their labors at once. As dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Omaha, he ran the college while at the same time teaching psychology. As assistant athletic director, he controlled the university athletic programs and directed them with all the gusto of a former football player and sports fanatic. This role made him so prominent that every cop in town knew him, says Buffett, which was a good thing because of the way he drove. He also designed IQ tests and psychology tests and supervised the testing of all the city's schoolchildren. Not content to enjoy a day of rest from bossing people around and testing their children, on Sundays he donned the vestments of an ordained minister and preached very slowly in a deep, booming voice at the tiny Irvington Christian Church, where his daughters made up the two-person choir. The rest of the time, he broadcast his political beliefs, which were similar to Howard Buffett's, to anyone who came within the sound of his voice. Doc Thompson expressed his wishes with a jovial smile while insisting that they be obeyed at once. He talked of the importance of women while expecting them to wait on him. His work revolved around the inner self, but he was noticeably vain. He clung to those he loved, growing nervous when they were out of his sight. A chronically anxious hypochondriac, he often predicted that some sort of disaster would befall anyone he cared about. He lavished affection on those who satisfied his demanding ways. The Thompsons' older daughter, Dorothy, known as Dottie, was not one of those. According to family lore, during the first few years of Dottie's life, when her father was especially displeased with her, he locked her in a closet. A charitable interpretation would be that the pressure of trying to finish his Ph.D. with a toddler underfoot unhinged him. 7 years after Dottie's arrival, their second daughter, Susie, was born. Dorothy Thompson, seeing how badly Dottie was responding to her husband's harsh child-rearing methods, supposedly asserted herself to tell him, "That one was yours. I'm raising the next." Susie was sickly from birth. She had allergies and chronic ear infections and endured a dozen ear lancings during her first 18 months. She suffered through long bouts of rheumatic fever, and her illnesses confined her to the house for 4 or 5 months at a time from kindergarten through second grade. She later recalled watching her friends playing outside her window during these periods while she longed to join them. Through her many illnesses, the Thompsons constantly comforted, cuddled, and rocked their daughter. Her father doted on her. "There was nothing in his life remotely approaching her," says Warren. "Susie could do no wrong, but everything that Dottie did was wrong. They were always critical of her." A family home movie shows Susie, about age 4, shouting "No!" and ordering around Dottie, age 11, as they played with a tea set. When at last Susie was well and no longer a prisoner of her bedroom, she never chose to play sports or games outdoors, but was always eager to make friends. It was people she had missed during those long days of illness. "When you've had pain," Susie later recalled, "the release from it can be totally freeing. It's marvelous. To be free of pain is a great state of being. I learned that at a very young age. Knowing that, you can be very simple-minded about life. And then you get with people and think, boy, people are really fascinating." As Susie grew older, she retained her girlish round cheeks and a breathy, deceptively childlike voice. During her teens, she went to Omaha's Central High, an integrated school with a student body of different faiths and colors, unusual in the 1940s. Even though she was part of a crowd that some considered snobbish, her classmates recall her as having friends among all these groups. Her exuberant warmth and her ethereal way of speaking could come across as a little phony, even a little loopy, but her friends said there wasn't anything phony about her. Her interests ran to speech and performing arts rather than academics. She argued with passion and persuasiveness on the Central High debate team, where people noticed that her politics had strayed far from her father's. She acted charmingly in school plays and sang in a smooth contralto in school operettas and as a mainstay of the choir. Her performance as the sweetly harebrained lead in "Our Hearts Were Young and Gay" so sparkled that her teachers recalled it for years afterward. Indeed, her charm and strength of personality made her most popular, a lady-in-waiting to the school sweetheart Miss Central, and led her classmates to elect her senior class president. Susie's first boyfriend was John Gilmore, a quiet, bland boy whom she openly adored. By the time he became her steady at Central High, Gilmore towered over her by almost a foot, but despite her kittenish demeanor, she dominated him. During those years, she also began dating a friendly, intelligent boy she had met at a freshman debate competition. A student at Thomas Jefferson High School in Council Bluffs, Iowa, across the Missouri River from Omaha, Milton Brown was a tall, dark-haired young man with a warm, wide smile. They saw each other several times a week throughout high school. While her close friends were aware of Milt, it was Gilmore who continued to be her steady date for parties and school events. Susie's father did not approve of Brown, who was the son of an unschooled Russian-Jewish immigrant worker on the Union Pacific Railroad. The three or four times that she dared to bring him to the house, he was made to feel unwelcome by Doc Thompson, who lectured him about FDR and Truman. Susie's father made no secret of his determination to pry his daughter loose from dating a Jew. Like the Buffetts, Doc Thompson had all the prejudices typical of Omaha, where different ethnic and religious groups kept to themselves, and life for a couple of mixed religion would be taxing at best. Yet Susie dared to cross these social lines, while at the same time managing to maintain another life as a conventional, popular high school girl. Susie navigated these choppy waters until she went to college, when she and Milt headed off to freedom, together, at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. There, she roomed with Bertie Buffett, and both pledged sororities. Bertie coasted through her classes and was immediately crowned as the Phi Delta Pajama Queen. Susie, a journalism major, had arranged her schedule so that she could see Milt nearly every day. The two joined the Wildcat Council together and met at the library after he got off of one of the several jobs he held after school to pay his tuition. Susie's unconventional choice to openly date a Jewish boy clashed with her life as a typical co-ed, and members of her sorority forbade her to bring Brown to a dance because he had pledged a Jewish fraternity. Susie, although hurt, did not depledge, but she and Milt began to study Zen Buddhism, looking for a faith that could reflect their common spiritual beliefs. Knowing nothing of this, Warren made his futile Thanksgiving trip to Evanston, then visited Susie in Omaha over the winter holidays. By then, he had made up his mind to pursue her seriously. She had the qualities he'd always looked for in a woman. She described herself as one of those few fortunate people who grew up with the feeling that I was unconditionally loved. That's the most wonderful gift you can give anyone. But the person she wanted to give her unconditional love to was Milt Brown. That spring of 1951, Milt was elected sophomore class president and Bertie its vice president. Susie cried every time she opened a letter from home demanding that she break off her relationship with Brown. Bertie could see what was going on, but Susie never confided in her, even though they had grown to be friends. She seemed to have a way of never letting anyone get inside her head. Then, one day as the semester neared an end, the two were sitting in their dorm room when the phone rang. It was Doc Thompson. "Come home now," he commanded. He wanted her away from Milt, and he let her know she would not be going back to Northwestern in the fall. Susie collapsed, sobbing, but there was never any appeal of her father's decisions. After graduating from Columbia that spring, Warren, too, returned to Omaha. He would be living in his parents' home since they were away in Washington, but he would have to spend part of that first summer after his return fulfilling his obligation to the National Guard. Though he wasn't particularly well-suited to the Guard, it was better than the alternative, going off to fight in Korea. The Guard required him to attend training camp in La Crosse, Wisconsin for several weeks every year, however. Training camp did nothing to help him mature. "In the National Guard, at first, the guys were very suspicious of me because my dad was in Congress. They thought I was going to be some kind of prima donna or something, but that didn't last long. It's a very democratic organization. I mean, what you do outside doesn't mean much. To fit in, all you had to do was be willing to read comic books. About an hour after I got there, I was reading comic books. Everybody else was reading comic books, why shouldn't I? My vocabulary shrank to about 4 words, and you can guess what they were. I learned that it pays to hang around with people better than you are, because you will float upward a little bit. And if you hang around with people that behave worse than you, pretty soon you'll start sliding down the pole. It just works that way." The experience gave Warren incentive to make good on another vow just as soon as he got back from National Guard camp. "I was terrified of public speaking. You can't believe what I was like if I had to give a talk. I was so terrified that I just couldn't do it. I would throw up. In fact, I arranged my life so that I never had to get up in front of anybody. When I came out here to Omaha after graduating, I saw another ad. And I knew I was just going to have to speak in public sometimes. The agony was such that just to get rid of the pain, I signed up for the course again." That was not his only mission. To win the heart of Susan Thompson, he knew he would have to be able to converse with her as well. The odds against succeeding with Susie were long, but he would do anything to improve them, and this summer might be his last chance. The Dale Carnegie class met down at the Rome Hotel, a favorite of the cattlemen. I took $100 in cash and gave it to Wally Keenan, the instructor, and said, "Take it before I change my mind." There were about 25 or 30 of us in there. We were all just terrified. We couldn't say our own names. We all stood there and wouldn't talk to each other. Meanwhile, one thing that impressed me was that, after meeting all those people once, Wally could rattle off all our names from memory. He was a good teacher, and he tried to teach us the memory association trick, but I never learned that part. They gave us this book of speeches, keynote speech, election speech, lieutenant governor speech, and we were supposed to deliver these things every week. The way it works is that you learn to get out of yourself. I mean, why should you be able to talk alone with somebody 5 minutes before and then freeze in front of a group? So they teach you the psychological tricks to overcome this. Some of it is just practice, just doing it and practicing. We really helped each other through, and it worked. That's the most important degree that I have. Yet Warren could not try out his new skills on Susie, who made herself scarce. Mindful of Doc Thompson's influence over his daughter, Warren showed up every night, ukulele in tow, to romance her father in her stead. "She would go out with other guys," says Buffett, "and I didn't have anything to do when I would go over there. So I would flirt with him instead, and he and I would talk about things." Doc Thompson, who loved the summer heat, sat outside on the screened porch on the boiling July nights, dressed in his three-piece pastel wool suit, while Susie was secretly out with Milt. Doc Thompson played the mandolin while Warren sweated and sang, accompanying him on the ukulele. Warren felt comfortable with Doc Thompson, whose style reminded him of his father's way of holding forth on how the world was going to hell because of the Democrats. Whitaker Chambers' autobiography, Witness, describing his conversion from communist spy to ardent Cold War anti-communist, had just been released. Warren had read this book with great interest, in part because of its description of the Alger Hiss case. Chambers had accused Hiss of being a communist spy, an accusation that had been pooh-poohed by people the Buffetts considered political enemies, the Truman crowd. Only Richard Nixon, a young senator on the House Un-American Activities Committee, had pursued Hiss, leading to Hiss's conviction for perjury in January 1950. This was the kind of fodder that Doc Thompson could chew on endlessly. Unlike Howard, however, he also talked about sports. He had no sons, and he thought Warren was the best thing since bubblegum. Warren was smart, Warren was Protestant, Warren was Republican, and above all, Warren was not Milt Brown. The support of Bill Thompson was not as much of a plus as it might have seemed. Warren was up against stiff odds in winning Susie's heart. She could overlook his baggy socks and cheap suits. It was the rest that worked against him. He came across to her as a congressman's son, somebody considered special, a boy who had every advantage, a graduate degree and a good bit of money, and who was obviously headed for success. He talked about stocks all the time, a subject she cared nothing about. His way of entertaining a date was telling rehearsed jokes, riddles, and brain teasers. That her father liked Warren so much made her think of Warren as an extension of her father's control. Doc Thompson practically threw Susie at Warren. "It was two against one," says Buffett. Milt, who needed her, suffered the injustice of being a Jew from literally the wrong side of the tracks. He was all the more attractive because he was the guy her father couldn't stand. That summer, Brown was working in Council Bluffs. When he got a letter from Northwestern notifying him of a tuition increase, he realized he couldn't afford to go back to Evanston. So he went over to the Buffett house and handed Bertie, his class vice president, a letter saying that he was transferring to the University of Iowa. Susie was enrolling that fall at the University of Omaha, and by then, she and Milt had to acknowledge that, because of her father, they were off and on. She spent the summer in tears. Meanwhile, despite her initial lack of interest in Warren, Susie could never spend time with anyone without wanting to learn all about him. She soon started to realize that her first impression had been wrong. He was not the privileged, cocky, self-confident guy she thought. "I was a wreck," he recalls. He was jittering on the brink of a nervous breakdown. "I felt odd. I was socially inept, but beyond that, I hadn't found a cruising speed in life." Even her friends noticed the vulnerability that lay beneath his veneer of self-assurance. Susie gradually recognized how worthless he felt inside. All that confident chatter about stocks, the aura of a prodigy, the tinny twang of the ukulele were wrapped around a fragile, needy core. A boy who was stumbling through his days in a shroud of desolation. "I was a mess," he says. It was incredible the way Susie saw through to some of that. Indeed, somebody who felt like a wreck and a mess was catnip to Susie. Warren would later say of her need to turn him into a cause that he was Jewish enough for Susie, but not too Jewish for her dad. And so she started coming around. Warren, who was nearly blind to the way others dressed, even women, was so in love with Susie by now that he actually noticed her clothes. He would never forget the blue dress she wore on their dates, or the black and white print outfit he called the newspaper dress. Amid the summer fireflies at the Peony Park Pavilion, they stumbled around the dance floor to the sounds of a Glenn Miller tune. Warren had still never learned to dance and tried as hard as he could. He was about as cozy on the dance floor as a sixth grader at a sorority social. But I would have done anything she asked, he says. I would have let her put worms down the back of my shirt. By Labor Day, when Warren took her to the state fair, they were a couple. Susie registered at the university as a sophomore majoring in journalism, signed up for the debate team, and enrolled in the Association for the Study of Group Dynamics, a psychology group. Warren wrote his Aunt Dorothy Stahl in October 1951 in his best smart-alecky style, "Things in the girl department are at an all-time peak. The hooks have been sunk pretty deep into me by one of the local gals. As soon as I get the go-ahead from my Uncle Fred and you, I may proceed further. This girl has only one drawback. She knows nothing about stocks. Otherwise, she is unbeatable, and I guess I can overlook her Achilles heel." Cautiously proceeding further was putting it right. Warren worked up his nerve. Instead of proposing marriage, he just sort of assumed it and kept talking. Susie, for her part, realized she had been chosen, although she wasn't sure how. Triumphant, Warren went to his Dale Carnegie class on schedule. "That's the week I won the pencil." They gave a pencil award for doing something difficult and doing the most with the training. The week I won the pencil was the week that I proposed. Afterward, Susie wrote a long, sad letter to Milton Brown, telling him the news. He was shocked. He knew she had been out on some dates with Warren, but had no idea it was anything serious. Warren went to talk to Susie's father to get his blessing. This, he already knew, would be easily had. But Doc Thompson took a while, quite a while, to get to the point. He started by explaining that Harry Truman and the Democrats were sending the country straight to hell. Pouring money into Europe after the war through the Marshall Plan and the Berlin Airlift was just proof that the policies of that devil Roosevelt were still in place, and that Truman was sending the country straight into bankruptcy. Look at how the Soviets got hold of the atomic bomb right after Truman had dismantled part of the military. Senator Joe McCarthy's House Un-American Activities Committee was proving what Doc Thompson had known all along, that the government was riddled with communists. HUAC was finding commies everywhere. The government was downright ineffectual, or worse, when it came to dealing with communism. Truman had lost China for democracy. He would never be forgiven for firing the heroic General Douglas MacArthur for insubordination after he made repeated efforts to go around Truman and get approval to attack the Chinese commies in Manchuria. But it was probably too late for even MacArthur to save the country now. The communists were taking over the world, and stocks were going to be nothing but valueless bits of paper. So Warren's plan to work in the stock market was going to fail. But Doc Thompson would never blame Warren when his daughter starved. He was a smart young man. If not for the Democrats ruining the country, he would probably do all right. The miserable future that awaited Susie wouldn't be Warren's fault. Long used to this kind of talk, from both his own father and Susie's, Warren waited patiently for the crucial word, yes. 3 hours later, Doc Thompson wound his way to a conclusion and gave his consent. By Thanksgiving, Susie and Warren were planning their April wedding. Chapter 19. Stage Fright. Omaha, summer 1951 to spring 1952. Warren understood Doc Thompson's concern about how he would support a family, even though he had no such doubts himself. Since he couldn't work for Graham Newman, he had decided to become a stockbroker and to do it in Omaha, far from the canyons of Wall Street. If you wanted to make money in the stock market, went the common wisdom, the place to do it was New York, so his decision was an unusual one. But he felt free from the conventions of Wall Street. He wanted to work with his father. Susie was in Omaha, and he was never happy far from home. At almost 21, Warren was supremely confident in his own investing abilities. By the end of 1951, he had already boosted his capital from $9,804 to $19,738. He had earned 75% in a single year. As a matter of course, however, he consulted his father and Ben Graham. To his surprise, both said, "Maybe you should wait a few years." Graham, as always, thought the market was too high. Howard, pessimistic, favored mining stocks and gold stocks and other investments designed to protect against inflation. He didn't think any other kind of business would be a good investment, and he worried about his son's future. That didn't make sense to Warren. Since 1929, the value of businesses had grown substantially. It was absolutely the reverse effect of what you saw in other times, when the market was staggeringly overvalued. I had looked at companies. I just couldn't see why you wouldn't want to own them. It was on a micro level, not an assessment of the growth of the economy or anything like that, and I was working with micro money. But it just seemed to me that it was crazy not to own them. On the other hand, here's Ben, with his 200 IQ and all experience, telling me to wait, and my dad, who, if he told me to walk out a window, I would have done it. Still, to make this decision to defy the advice of his two great authorities, his father and Ben Graham, was an enormous step for him. It required him to consider the possibility that his judgment might be superior to theirs, and that the two men whom he most deeply respected were not thinking rationally. Yet he was certain he was right. He might have walked out a window if his father told him to, but not if it meant leaving a Moody's manual full of cheap stocks behind. In fact, the opportunities he saw were so plentiful that they justified borrowing money for the first time. He was willing to take on debt equal to a quarter of his net worth. I was already running short of money to invest. If I was enthused about a stock, I would have to sell something else to buy it. I had an aversion to borrowing money, but I got a loan for $5,000 or so from the Omaha National Bank. I was under 21, and my dad had to co-sign the loan. Mr. Davis, the banker, conducted it as a rite of passage. He said something like, "You're going into manhood now," and referred to this $5,000, saying, "It's a solemn obligation, and we know you've got the kind of character to pay it back." This went on for half an hour while I was sitting there next to this big desk. Howard probably felt both proud and a little silly co-signing a loan for his son, who had been a full-fledged businessman for at least a dozen years. Since Warren had made up his mind, Howard was also willing to take him on at his own firm, Buffett Falk, though only after suggesting that he interview at a prominent local firm, Kirkpatrick Pettis Co., to see what the best of Omaha stockbroking had to offer. I went to see Stuart Kirkpatrick and said during the interview that I wanted intelligent customers. I was going to try to look for people who could understand things. And Kirkpatrick said, in effect, "Don't worry about whether they're intelligent. Worry about whether they're rich." Which is okay, you can't knock him for that, but I wouldn't have wanted to work any place but at my dad's firm. At Buffett Falk, Warren was installed in one of its four private unair-conditioned offices, next to the cage, a glassed-in area where a clerk handled the money and securities. He started out selling his favorite stock to the safest people he knew, his aunt and his college friends, including his first roommate at Wharton, Chuck Peterson, who was now in the real estate business in Omaha and with whom he'd reconnected. My Aunt Alice was the first call I made, and I sold her 100 shares of Geico. She made me feel good about myself. She was interested in me. And after that, Fred Stanback, Chuck Peterson, and anybody I could get to buy it. But mostly I got myself to buy it, because when other people didn't buy it, I'd just figure out a way to buy 5 more shares myself. I had this big ambition. I was going to own 0.1% of the company. It had 175,000 shares outstanding, and I figured if the company would become worth $1 billion someday and I owned that much, I would be worth $1 million, so I needed 175 shares. Yet in the meantime, his job was to sell on commission, and beyond this narrow circle, Warren found that almost insurmountably difficult. He got a taste of the obstacles his father had faced to build his brokerage business back when the grand old families of Omaha, the owners of the banks, stockyards, breweries, the big department stores, peered down their noses at the grandson of a grocer. Alone in Omaha now, with his parents back in Washington, Warren felt that he got no respect. These were the days when all stocks were sold by full-service stockbrokers, and most people bought individual stocks rather than mutual funds. Everybody paid fixed commissions of 6 cents a share. Transactions took place in person or over the telephone as part of a relationship. Every trade was preceded by a few minutes of chat with your broker, part salesman, part advisor, part friend. Your broker might live in your neighborhood, and you saw him at parties. You golfed with him at your country club, and he came to your daughter's wedding. General Motors brought out new models of its cars every year, and a businessman might trade his car more often than his stocks. That is, if he owned any stocks. Important accounts didn't take Warren seriously. Nebraska Consolidated Mills, a client of his father's, once scheduled him to come out at 5:30 a.m. I was 21, and I'd go around to all these people to sell them stocks, and when I'd get all through, they'd say, "What does your dad think?" I got that all the time. Warren, who looked like a dork, struggled to make sales. He didn't know how to read people, couldn't make small talk, and certainly wasn't a good listener. His mode of conversation was to broadcast rather than receive. When nervous, he sprayed forth information about his favorite stocks like a fire hose. Some potential clients listened to his pitch, checked with other sources, and used his ideas, but bought the stocks through other brokers, so he didn't get the commission. He was shocked at this perfidy from people he'd spoken to face to face and would be seeing again around town. He felt cheated. Other times he was simply baffled. Once he walked in on a guy who was in his 70s sitting with a pile of dollar bills on his desk and a secretary in his lap. Every time she kissed him, the man gave her a dollar bill. My dad hadn't taught me what to do in that sort of circumstance. Generally speaking, I was not getting reinforcement. When I first started selling Geico to people, Buffett Falk had this little office downtown, and the stock certificates would come in and Jerome Newman's name would be on those certificates. He was the seller I was buying from. And the guys at Buffett Falk said, "What the hell? If you think you're smarter than Jerry Newman." In fact, Graham Newman was forming a new partnership, and some of the investors had given the firm Geico shares to fund money into the partnership. So, in effect, it was they who were selling, not Graham Newman. Warren didn't know that. But when it came to Geico, he didn't care who was selling. It did not occur to him to ask anyone at the firm why they were selling. He was unshakably certain of his own opinion. Nor did he hide that fact. I was sort of a wise guy with this graduate degree among people who hadn't gone to college. One time an insurance agent, Ralph Campbell, came in to see Mr. Falk and said, "What's this kid doing going around promoting this company?" Geico was a company that didn't use insurance agents, and I said, like a wise guy, "Mr. Campbell, you better buy this stock for unemployment insurance." The full import of Dale Carnegie's first rule, "Don't criticize," hadn't sunk in. Warren used what would later become the trademark Buffett wit to show that he knew more than everybody else. But why would anyone have been willing to believe that of a 21-year-old? And yet he did. It must have stunned people at Buffett Falk to watch him, morning through night, ripping through the manuals, adding to his file cabinets of knowledge. I went through the Moody's manuals page by page. 10,000 pages in the Moody's industrial, transportation, banks, and finance manuals. Twice. I actually looked at every business, although I didn't look very hard at some. Even though endlessly fascinated by the game of finding stocks, Warren wanted to be more than an investor, more than a salesman. He wanted to be a teacher, to emulate Ben Graham. He signed up to teach a night course at the University of Omaha. At first, he partnered with his stockbroker friend Bob Soner, who taught the first 4 weeks of Profitable Investing in Stocks. While Soner explained to the class basics, such as how to read the Wall Street Journal, Warren stood in the hallway listening for any good investment ideas. Then he took over for the next 6 weeks. Eventually, he taught the whole course and gave it the more cautious name of sound investing in stocks. In front of his classroom, he lit up, pacing the floor as if he couldn't get the words out fast enough, even though the students had to struggle not to drown in the flood of information he threw at them. But despite his deep vein of knowledge, he never promised the class they would get rich or that taking his class would give them any particular result. Nor did he brag about his own success at investing. His students ranged from stock market professionals to people who had no head for business, housewives, doctors, retirees. They symbolized a subtle shift. Long-absent investors were starting to come back for the first time since the 1920s, part of why Graham thought the market was overvalued. Warren adapted his teaching to the range of their knowledge and skills. He modeled his teaching style after Graham's, using the Company A, Company B method, and some of his mentor's other little teaching tricks. He handed out grades with the strictest fairness. His Aunt Alice took the course and sat in the classroom gazing at him with adoring eyes. He gave her a C. People were always throwing out the names of stocks, asking him whether to buy or sell. He could speak from memory for 5 or even 10 minutes about any stock they named, its financial data, price-earnings ratio, the volume of shares that traded. And from all appearances, he could do this for hundreds of stocks, as if he were quoting baseball statistics. Sometimes a woman in the front row would say, "My late mother gave me ABC stock, and now it's up a little bit. What should I do?" Then he would say, "Well, I think I would sell that, and maybe buy," giving 3 or 4 options, such as Geico or one of the few stocks about which he was entirely confident and already owned. The students remarked on his unusual conservatism when responding to their questions about how to invest. Meanwhile, Warren was working like a woodpecker in April to make money for himself. He was going to be taking care of a family soon, which would divide his income into 2 streams. Part of what he made, his stream, would go back into the mill and continue to grow, and part he would spend for him and Susie to live, a significant change in his circumstances. Until now, he had been able to pare his expenses by living in the maid's room at Columbia, eating cheese sandwiches, and taking his dates to lectures or playing the ukulele for them instead of escorting them to the posh 21 Club. Now that he was back in Nebraska, he was able to cut his costs even further by living in his parents' house, even though it meant occasional contact with Lila when they came back from Washington. He had never needed motivation to try to work his capital as hard as possible. And now he sat in the office at Buffett Falk with his feet on his desk, searching systematically through the Graham and Dodd book for more ideas. He found a stock, Philadelphia and Reading Coal and Iron Company, a company that mined anthracite coal. It looked cheap because it was selling for $19 and a fraction, but had about $8 a share worth of culm banks, also known as bony piles, residue from removing impurities like shale and dust from raw coal. Once thought to have value, today they are abandoned, catch hard-to-extinguish fires, and even cause whole towns to relocate. Warren would happily spend hours figuring out how much coal mines and coal banks were worth in order to make a rational decision about a stock. He bought Philadelphia and Reading Coal and Iron shares himself and sold them to his Aunt Alice and Chuck Peterson. When the stock immediately dropped to $9 a share, he saw that as a reason to buy even more. He bought a textile company called Cleveland Worsted Mills. It had current assets of $146 per share, and the stock was selling for less than that. Current assets are a measure of liquidity, how fast a company can raise cash. They include cash, easily saleable investments, inventory, and money due from others. They exclude items like real estate, equipment, debt, and pensions, which cannot be readily liquidated or are owed to others. He felt the price did not reflect the value of several well-equipped mills. Warren wrote a short report on the stock. He liked the fact that the company was paying out a lot of what it earned to shareholders, giving them a bird in the hand. The $8 dividend provides a well-protected 7% yield on the current price of approximately $115, the report noted. He wrote, "well-protected," because he thought Cleveland Worsted Mills had enough earnings to cover its dividend. That proved less than prescient. "I called it Cleveland's Worst Mill after they cut off paying the dividend." Warren was so mad that he decided to spend some money to find out what was wrong. "I went to an annual meeting of Cleveland's Worst Mill, and I flew all the way to Cleveland. I got there about 5 minutes late, and the meeting had been adjourned. And here I was, this kid from Omaha, 22 years old, with my own money in the stock. The chairman said, "Sorry, too late." But then their sales agent, who was on the board of directors, actually took pity on me, and so he got me off on the side and talked to me and answered some questions. The answers, however, changed nothing. Warren felt awful. He had gotten other people to buy Cleveland's worst mill, too. There was nothing he hated more than selling people investments that lost them money. He couldn't stand disappointing people. This was what it had been like back in the sixth grade when the city's service preferred stock he'd gotten Doris to invest in was clobbered. She hadn't hesitated to remind him about it, and he'd felt responsible. Now he would do anything to avoid the feeling of letting someone down. Warren began looking for any way to make himself less dependent on the job he was starting to hate. He had always enjoyed owning businesses and decided to buy a gas station with a friend from the National Guard, Jim Schaefer. They bought a Sinclair station that was next to a Texaco station that consistently outsold us, which drove us crazy. Warren and his brother-in-law, Truman Wood, who had married Doris, even worked at the station themselves on weekends. They washed windshields with a smile, despite Warren's aversion to manual labor, and did everything they could to attract new customers. But instead, drivers continued to pull into the Texaco station across the street. Its owner was very well established and very well liked. He beat us every month. That's when I learned the power of customer loyalty. The guy had been in business forever and had a clientele. Nothing we could do was going to change that. My service station was the dumbest thing. I lost $2,000, and that was a lot of money for me at the time. I'd never had real damage in a loss. It was painful. It seemed to Warren that nearly everything he did in Omaha reinforced his sense of youth and inexperience. He was no longer a precocious boy who was acting like a man, but a young man, about to get married, who looked and sometimes acted like a boy. Kaiser Frazier, the stock he had shorted 2 years before in Bob Soner's office, still hung stubbornly around $5 a share instead of going to zero as he had expected. Carl Falk was always giving him funny looks and questioning his judgment, and Warren felt more and more queasy about the very nature of his job. He started to think of himself as being like a prescriptionist. I had to explain to people who didn't know enough about whether they should take an aspirin or Anacin, and people would do anything the guy in the white coat, the stockbroker, told them to do. The stockbroker got paid based on turnover instead of advice. In other words, he's getting paid based on how many pills he sells. He gets paid more for some pills than others. You wouldn't go to a doctor whose pay was totally contingent on how many pills you took. But that's how the business of being a stockbroker worked at the time. Warren felt there was a conflict of interest inherent in the business. He'd recommend a stock like Geico to his friends and family, and then tell them that the best thing to do was to hold it for 20 years. That meant he didn't get any more commissions from them. You can't make a living that way. The system pits your interests against your clients. Nevertheless, he had begun to develop a small clientele of his own through his network of graduate school friends. In the spring of 1952, he went to Salisbury, North Carolina, to spend Easter with Fred Stanback. He charmed and amused Fred's parents and entertained the family by talking stocks, quoting Ben Graham, and asking for a Pepsi Cola and a ham sandwich for breakfast. Soon afterward, back in Omaha, Fred Stanback's father gave him an order to sell some stock in a washing machine company, Thor Corporation. Warren found a customer through another broker, Harris Upham, who wanted to buy it. Then he got another call from Stanback's bank about the sale and thought he had two orders. He sold the Thor Corporation stock twice, the second time unwittingly selling stock he didn't have. Now he had to find additional shares and ended up buying them at a loss to cover the second sale. Mr. Stanback treated him graciously despite the mistake. He absorbed the entire loss, even though it was Warren's fault. Warren was grateful and never forgot it. He had more reason for concern about the second buyer, a man known as Mad Dog Baxter, who was a remnant of Omaha's days as a major gambling layoff center. In a layoff center, bookies bet to balance their books and even their odds, and an associate in some of the city's many illegal betting parlors. Baxter had arrived at Buffett Falk in person, strolled up to the cashier's cage, and pulled out a wad of $100 bills, waving it around ostentatiously. Once again, Carl Falk looked at me questioningly. Was Buffett Falk being used to launder illegal gambling money? Situations like this reinforced Warren's dislike for his job. Even when he wasn't selling stocks, he felt conflicted. He had turned Buffett Falk into a market maker, a firm that acted as a middleman, buying and selling stocks as a dealer. The firm made a profit by selling a stock to clients at a slightly higher price than it paid, and buying stock from clients at a lower price than it sold the stock for. The difference, or spread, was its profit. The spread was invisible to the customers. Acting as a market maker lifted a brokerage firm from being a mere order taker to being a player in the Wall Street game. While Warren was proud that he had the know-how to set Buffett Falk up as a market maker, the conflict bothered him. I don't want to be on the other side of the table from the customer. I never was selling anything I didn't believe in myself or own myself. On the other hand, there was a markup that was undisclosed. If anybody asked me about it, I told them. But I don't like anything like that. I want to be on the same side of the table with the people who are my partners, everybody knowing what's going on. And a promoter, by his nature, doesn't do that. No matter how Warren thought about his job as a stockbroker, there was always a potential conflict of interest, and always the possibility that he would lose money for his clients and open himself up to disappointing them. He would much rather manage people's money instead of selling them stocks, with his interest on the same side as the customers. The problem was, there were no such opportunities in Omaha. But in the spring of 1952, he wrote an article about Geico that attracted the attention of a powerful man, and with that, his luck seemed about to change. The article, "The Security I Like Best," which appeared in the Commercial and Financial Chronicle, was not just an advertisement for Warren's favorite stock, but an explanation of his ideas about investing. It caught the attention of Bill Rosenwald, who was a son of Julius Rosenwald, a philanthropist and the longtime chairman of Sears Roebuck & Co. The younger Rosenwald ran American Securities, a money management firm launched with family stock in Sears that sought high returns while minimizing risk and preserving capital. After contacting Ben Graham, who gave Warren a strong recommendation, Rosenwald offered Warren a job. Few jobs in money management were as prestigious, and Warren was dying to accept it, even though that meant moving back to New York City. To do so, however, he had to get permission from the National Guard to leave Omaha. "I asked my commanding officer whether it would be possible to transfer to New York to take this job. He said, 'You'll have to go down and see the commanding general.' So I went down to Lincoln, sat there in the state capitol, waited a while, went in to see General Henninger and said, 'Corporal Buffett reporting.' I'd written him ahead of time explaining and asking permission. And right away he said, 'Permission denied.' That was the end of it. That meant I was in Omaha as long as he wanted to keep me captive." Thus Warren was stuck at Buffett Falk, writing prescriptions for a living. The main comfort he had during the challenges of his first year back in Omaha was his fiancée. He had begun to lean on Susie. All the while, she was working at figuring Warren out. She began to understand the damage Lila Buffett's rages had done to her son's self-worth, and she started trying to repair it. She knew that the main thing he needed was to feel loved and never criticized. He also needed to feel that he could succeed socially. "People accepted me more when I was with her," he says. Even though she was still at the University of Omaha while he had been working, he was like a toddler gazing up at a parent when it came to his relationship with his future wife. Both were still living in their parents' homes. Over time, Warren had developed a way of dealing with his mother, which was to avoid being alone with her, while making use of her dutiful nature when in her presence by besieging her with demands and requests. Yet the long stretches that he had spent away from her while attending college had lowered his tolerance for Lila's company instead of raising it. When she and Howard came back from Washington for Warren and Susie's wedding, Susie noticed that her fiancé avoided his mother as much as he could. When forced to be in her company, he would turn his face away from her and clench his teeth. It was time for Warren to move out. He called Chuck Peterson, saying, "Chazzo, I haven't got a place for us to live." And Chazzo rented him a tiny apartment a couple of miles from downtown. When Warren gave Susie, who had a strong sense of self-expression, an allowance of $1,500 to furnish their first apartment, she and her future sister-in-law, Doris, took off for Chicago to shop for furniture in the colorful modern style she liked. As the wedding date, April 19, 1952, approached, the question arose whether the ceremony would take place at all. The week before, the Missouri River flooded upstream of Omaha. With the waters heading south, officials predicted they would crest above the riverbank and flood the city during the weekend. This made it likely that the National Guard would be called out. The whole town turned out with sandbags. I had all these buddies coming in for the wedding. Fred Standback was going to be best man, and various ushers and guests. They were all kidding me because I was in the National Guard. They said, "Well, don't worry about it, because we'll substitute for you on the honeymoon." Jokes like that. This was going on all week. A few days beforehand, Howard drove Warren and Fred down to the river. Thousands of volunteers were building double walls of sandbags, 6 feet high and 4 feet deep. The earth sank under the wheels of the huge trucks hauling sand and dirt as if they were driving over rubber. Warren held his breath, hoping that he would not be called for duty to sandbag and that the temporary levee would hold. Saturday came, and we were getting married about 3 in the afternoon. Around noon, the phone rang. My mother said, "It's for you." I picked up the phone. The guy at the other end said, "Corporal Buffett?" I had a commanding officer who had a really distinctive stutter. "This is Captain Murphy," he said. If he hadn't stuttered, I'd have said something that'd probably have gotten me court-martialed, because I would have thought it was the guys pulling a trick on me. But as it was, he said, "We've been activated. What time can you show up at the armory?" Warren almost had a heart attack. And I said, "Well, I'm getting married at 3 o'clock, I said. I could probably be there by 5. He said, "Report for duty. We're going to be patrolling East Omaha down by the river." I said, "Yes, sir." I got off the phone totally depressed. Then I get a call an hour later, and this guy had a perfectly normal voice. He says, "Corporal Buffett?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "This is General Wood." That was the commanding general of the 34th Division, who lived way out in West Nebraska. General Wood said, "I'm countermanding Captain Murphy's order. Have a good time." He had 2 hours left before the biggest event of his life. Warren showed up at the soaring Gothic sanctuary of Dundee Presbyterian Church well before 3 o'clock. The wedding of a congressman's son and Doc Thompson's daughter was a major event in Omaha. Several hundred guests, including many of Omaha's top drawer people, were expected. Doc Thompson was so proud, he was popping buttons all over the place. I was so nervous that I just figured, well, I didn't wear my glasses so that I wouldn't be able to see all those people out there. Warren also asked the normally reserved Standback to distract him by talking so he wouldn't have to focus on what was happening. Bertie stood up for Susie as maid of honor, Susie's sister Dottie as matron of honor. After the photographs, the guests drank non-alcoholic punch and ate wedding cake downstairs in the linoleum-floored church basement. That was the normal thing to do. The Thompsons and the Buffetts weren't club people. Susie smiled wide as an ivory fan. Warren glowed incandescent and wrapped his arm around her waist as if trying to keep them both from sailing off into the air. After more photographs, they changed into their going-away clothes and ran through the crowd of cheering guests to duck into Alice Buffett's car, which she had lent them for the honeymoon. Warren had already loaded the back seat with Moody's manuals and ledgers. All of a sudden, Susie saw the writing on the wall. And from Omaha, the newlyweds set off on their honeymoon, a cross-country automobile trip. On my wedding night, I had chicken-fried steak at the Wigwam Cafe in Wahoo, Nebraska, Buffett says. The wigwam was a tiny hole in the wall less than an hour from Omaha, with a few booths and cowboy decor. From there, Warren and Susie drove 30 miles to the Cornhusker Hotel in Lincoln to spend the night. "And that's all I'll say on that subject," Buffett says. The next day I bought a copy of the Omaha World Herald, and it had run an article that said, "Only love can stop the guard." The 1952 flood was the worst in modern times in Omaha, the effort spent to avert it Herculean. The other guys were sandbagging for days, patrolling in the flood with the snakes and rats. I was the only guy that didn't get called out. The newlyweds traveled all over the western and southwestern United States. Warren had never been there, but Susie knew the West Coast well. They visited her family, took in the sights, went to the Grand Canyon, and had a wonderful time. We did not stop to visit companies and look at investments, as has been reported, Buffett insists. On the way back, they stopped in Las Vegas, which was full of ex-Omaha people. The layoff bookies, Eddie Barrick and Sam Ziegman, had moved there shortly before and bought into the Flamingo Hotel. They were soon followed by another associate, Jackie Gowen, who had invested in casinos from the Flamingo to the Barbary Coast. All these characters had shopped at the Buffett grocery store, and Fred Buffett got along well with them, even though he wasn't a gambler. For Warren, Vegas felt almost homey, carrying echoes of the racetrack and full of people who knew his family, so he was not afraid of the house. Susie won a jackpot on the slot machine. She was only 19. They wouldn't pay her because she was underage. I said, "Look it, you took her nickels," and they paid her. After Vegas, the Buffetts headed back to Omaha. Warren could not stop chortling over his luckless colleagues in the guard. Oh, the honeymoon was great. It was great. 3 weeks. And all the time, these guys in the guard were sloshing it up. Part 3. The Racetrack. Chapter 20. Graham Newman. Omaha and New York City, 1952 to 1955. A few months after the wedding, Susie went to Chicago with her parents and new in-laws for the Republican convention in July of 1952. The Thompsons and the Buffetts descended on Chicago, not as delegates, but as part of an army. Politically speaking, at least, they were now one united family, and this election year they were on a crusade to reclaim the White House for the Republicans after 20 agonizing years under the Democrats. Doris would be working behind the scenes alongside her father, while the much younger Bertie and Susie, innocents at the spectacle, spent their time gawking at celebrities like John Wayne, who had shown up for the grand old party. Warren, of course, stayed in Omaha, grinding away. Politics fascinated him, but not like money. He still hated working as a prescriptionist, and kept toiling at it while trying to find a way out. His old teacher David Dodd tried to help him by referring him to the Value Line Investment Survey, an investment advisor and research publisher which was looking for new men. The job would have paid well, at least $7,000 a year. But Warren did not plan to be an anonymous researcher, so he carried on trying to sell Geico to uninterested clients while reading the convention news that was being reported under inch-high headlines in the newspapers. For the first time in history, a convention was also being covered on television, and Warren watched eagerly, struck by the power of this medium to magnify and influence events. The front-runner going into the convention was Senator Robert Taft of Ohio. Known as Mr. Integrity, Taft headed a minority wing of the Republican Party, centered around isolationist Midwesterners, that wanted the government to be small, to stay out of everybody's business, and above all, to go after communism more aggressively than Truman had done. Taft made his friend Howard Buffett head of his Nebraska presidential campaign, and also head of his Speaker's Bureau. To oppose Taft, the so-called Eastern liberal establishment that Howard so despised had drafted retired General Dwight D. Eisenhower, a moderate who had served as the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe during World War II and was the first supreme commander of NATO forces. Eisenhower, a politically adroit diplomat with excellent leadership skills, was a popular figure viewed by many as a war hero. As the convention approached, Ike began to catch up in the polls. What would prove to be the most controversial Republican convention in history unfolded in Chicago as Eisenhower backers pushed through an amendment to the convention rules, passed on a contentious vote, that handed him the delegates to win the nomination on the first ballot. Taft's outraged supporters felt robbed, but Eisenhower soon made peace with them by promising to combat creeping socialism, and Taft insisted that his followers swallow their outrage and vote for Eisenhower for the sake of regaining the White House. The Republicans united behind him and his running mate, Richard Nixon. I Like Ike buttons sprouted everywhere. Everywhere, that is, except on Howard Buffett's chest. He broke with the party by refusing to endorse Eisenhower. This was an act of political suicide. His support within the party evaporated overnight. He was left standing on principle, alone. Warren recognized that his father had painted himself into a corner. From his earliest childhood, Warren had always tried to avoid broken promises, burned bridges, and confrontation. Now Howard's struggles branded three principles even deeper into his son: that allies are essential, that commitments are so sacred that by nature they should be rare, and that grandstanding rarely gets anything done. Eisenhower defeated Adlai Stevenson in the November election, and in January, Warren's parents dragged themselves back to Washington to finish out the rest of Howard's lame duck term. Warren, who had for some time recognized obsessive qualities in Howard and Lila that disadvantaged them in various ways, had begun to absorb something of his in-law's style. Dorothy Thompson was easygoing, and her husband, though autocratic, was more personable and astute at human relations than the rigorously idealistic Howard Buffett. The more time he spent with Susie and her family, the more they influenced him. "Warren," said Doc Thompson, who handed down advice with the authority of the Sermon on the Mount, "always surround yourself with women. They're more loyal and they work harder." His son-in-law hardly needed to be told that. Indeed, Warren had always craved being taken care of by women, as long as they didn't try to order him around. Susie could see that he was eager for her to assume a motherly role, so she wrapped herself around her husband as she worked on fixing him, the wreck, the mess. "Oh, my God," she said, "he was a case." When they met, she recalled, "I had never seen anyone in so much pain." Warren may not have been aware of the depths or dimensions of his pain, but describes the powerful role she played in his life. "Susie was as big an influence on me as my dad, or bigger, probably, in a different way. I had all these defense mechanisms that she could explain, but I can't. She probably saw things in me that other people couldn't see, but she knew it would take time and a lot of nourishment to bring it out. She made me feel that I had somebody with a little sprinkling can who was going to make sure that the flowers grew." Susie recognized Warren's vulnerability, how much he needed to be soothed and comforted and reassured. More and more, she could see the effect his mother had had on her children. Doris was the more badly damaged, but Lila had convinced both Warren and Doris that deep down they were worthless. In every area of life except business, Susie was discovering, her husband was riddled with self-doubt. He had never felt loved, and she saw that he did not feel lovable. "I needed her like crazy," he says. "I was happy in my work, but I wasn't happy with myself. She literally saved my life. She resurrected me. She put me together. It was the same kind of unconditional love you would get from a parent." Warren wanted a lot of things from his wife that you would ordinarily get from a parent. Not only that, he had grown up with a mother who did everything for him. Now Susie took over. Although their basic model of wedded life was typical of the time, he made the money, she took care of him and covered the domestic front, their arrangement was extreme. Everything in the Buffett household revolved around Warren and his business. Susie understood her husband was special. She willingly became the cocoon for his embryonic ambitions. He spent his days working and his nights hunched over the Moody's manual. He also arranged his schedule to give himself leisure time to play golf and ping pong, even signing up as a junior member of the Omaha Country Club. Susie, barely 20 years old, was no Betty Crocker, but she had taken up rudimentary cooking and basic housekeeping like any 1950s wife, at a time when Omaha women were auditioning to appear on the show Typical Housewife on local television station KTMV. She devoted herself to fulfilling her husband's few but specific requirements: Pepsi in the refrigerator, a light bulb in his reading lamp, some indifferently cooked version of meat and potatoes for dinner, a shaker full of salt, popcorn in the cupboard, ice cream in the freezer. He also needed help getting dressed, assistance in dealing with people, tenderness, head rubs, cuddling, and hugs. She even cut his hair because he claimed he was afraid to go to the barber. Warren was nuts about Susie, and she felt things that were inside him, he says. He describes her role as the giver, his as the receiver. "She was absorbing more about me and sensing much more about me than I was sensing about her." They were always seen kissing and cuddling, Susie often in Warren's lap. She frequently said this reminded her of her father. 6 months after the wedding, Susie was pregnant and had dropped out of the University of Omaha. Her sister Dottie was pregnant, too, with her second baby. She and Susie had remained particularly close. A dark-haired beauty, Dottie resembled her father in intelligence, and, according to family lore, she had possessed the highest IQ in the school when she attended Central High. But in both looks and domesticity, she was more like her mother. She had married Homer Rogers, a pilot and war hero with a big baritone voice whom everybody called Buck Rogers, although he was modest about his war exploits. Homer was a convivial, energetic cattleman, as beefy as the oversized steers he bought and sold. The Rogerses always had a crowd at their house, Dottie playing piano while Homer sang something like, "Katie, Katie, get off the table, the money's for the beer." Susie and Warren did not take part in the Rogerses' active social life, since they tended to be more serious-minded and they did not drink, but the sisters spent a lot of time together on their own. Dottie had always had difficulty making decisions, and since having her first son, Billy, she seemed dazed at the demands of motherhood. Susie, naturally, took charge and helped her. Susie had also become close to her sister-in-law, Doris, who was working in Omaha as a schoolteacher now that she was married. Her husband, Truman Wood, was a handsome man with a pleasant personality who came from a prominent Omaha family, but Doris was starting to wonder if she was a racing filly hitched to a Clydesdale. A girl of action, Doris told Truman to giddy up. He ambled along a little faster, but not much. Susie's protectiveness toward Warren and his sister ticked up a notch in January 1953 after Eisenhower was sworn in, when Howard's final congressional term ended and he and Lila returned to Nebraska for good. Doris and Warren felt the strain of having Lila back in town. Warren could hardly bear to be in the same room with his mother, and she still turned on Doris periodically. Howard was at loose ends back in Omaha. Warren set up a partnership, Buffett and Buffett, that formalized the way they had occasionally bought stocks together. Howard contributed some capital, and Warren's contribution was a token amount of money, but mostly ideas and labor. But Howard looked at going back into the stockbroking business for the third time with dismay. Warren had been tending his old accounts while he served in Congress, but Howard knew that Warren hated it, had never stopped trying to get Ben Graham to hire him, and would leave in an instant if he could go to New York. For his part, Howard missed his true love, politics. He harbored a desire to enter the Senate, especially now that there was a Republican in the White House, yet his ambitions conflicted with his extreme political views. On July 30, 1953, Alice Buffett's birthday, Susie and Warren's first child, a daughter, was born. They named her Susan Alice and called her Little Susie, sometimes Little Suze, and Susie became a passionate, playful, and devoted mother. Little Susie was Howard and Lila's first grandchild. A week later, Susie's sister, Dottie, gave birth to her second son, Tommy. Within months, Doris became pregnant with her first child, a daughter, Robin Wood. By the spring of 1954, Susie was pregnant with her second child. Now the Buffetts and Thompsons had a new focus: grandchildren.